Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a classic talk by Noam Chomsky on how the economy really works and why it doesn't work. I hope you'll stay tuned. Progressive economist Richard Wolff points out the instability of the economic system we call capitalism. Once every 4 to 7 years, it crashes, bringing a recession or worse. 2020 saw the third crash and recession of the 21st century, right on schedule. Rather than acknowledge the awful instability of the system, capitalism's apologists blame the external triggers that brought about the system crash. So we had the so-called dot-com crash, then the mortgage loan crash, and now the COVID pandemic crash. This is me speaking. Imagine if your house collapsed and had to be rebuilt after a big wind, and then collapsed again during a drought, and then collapsed yet again in a hailstorm. Probably, after a while, you'd stop blaming the weather and start demanding better design and construction the next time you had to rebuild. So, sure, the pandemic made our creaky economy work worse. But don't blame just the pandemic. The whole capitalist economy is structurally unsound. And for centuries, the economy has defeated every effort to stabilize it. So said Richard Wolff in an interview heard on this very show a couple months ago. Interestingly enough, Noam Chomsky said much the same thing. Unlike Wolff, Chomsky is not trained as an economist, but he is highly knowledgeable about political science, and that perspective leads to the same conclusions. In fact, Chomsky explained it all before the COVID-triggered crash, in a classic speech from 2014. In a sense, that year seems so long ago, before Trump made an indelible imprint, like a giant ugly tattoo on our memories. Can anyone even remember Barack Obama? Born in Kenya, our first Muslim president? In any case, that's what Mr. Trump told us. Well, my point is that 2014 was before COVID, even before Trump, if anyone can remember that far back. But the structure of the economy has changed not at all in the past decades. That's because the economy serves very well those who own and control it. The 0.1% at the very top are doing better than ever. But the economy is not working so well for the 99%+ of us at the bottom. So Chomsky's talk still rings entirely true. Noam Chomsky spoke at a conference at Northeastern University in Boston on February 10, 2014. The talk is titled, How to Ruin an Economy, Some Simple Ways.
Let's suppose that for some perverse reason we're interested in ruining an economy and a society. So to make the problem interesting, we should select a difficult case. So say not the Central African Republic, where it could be done very easily. So let's pick a rich and powerful society. And best of all, let's select the richest and most powerful society in history, one with incomparable advantages, one that's fortunately close at hand, namely our own. So a good way to start is to ask, what would be signs of a successful economy? Well, to begin with, it should have people who are eager to work, plenty of badly needed work that should be done, and ample resources to combine idle hands with needed work. And that picture helps us sketch what a failed economy would look like, the opposite in all respects. And we don't have to look very far. Right here, there are tens of millions of people eager to work, but with no jobs. Many of them have simply dropped out of the workforce in despair. There are ample resources to provide employment, but they're hidden away where they cannot be accessed in the overflowing pockets of the super rich and the corporate sector, and particularly the big banks, which have been generously rewarded for having created a crisis serious enough to have almost brought down the domestic and even the global economy. And there are vast amounts of work to be done. The infrastructure's collapsing, schools badly need repair and teachers, the transportation and energy systems have to be radically reconstructed, and there's a great deal more ranging from construction work to scientific research. But the system is so dysfunctional that it cannot put eager hands to needed work using the resources that would be readily available if the economy were designed to serve human needs rather than wealth beyond the dreams of avarice for a privileged few. It's actually hard to think of a more serious indictment of a socioeconomic system. Well, as you all know, the dysfunctional economy has been accompanied by very highly concentrated wealth, and with it, of course, political power follows at once from concentrated wealth that in turn yields legislation that drives the cycle forward. Inequality has reached historic heights. In the past decade, 95% of growth has gone to 1% of the population, actually to a small proportion of those. Meanwhile, the general population has faced stagnation or decline. Median real income in the United States is below its level in 1989. For males, median real income is below what it was in 1968. The labor share of output has fallen to its lowest level since World War II, and poorer sectors have suffered severely. The United States has the highest poverty rate in the OECD, aside from Turkey, and that's perhaps not too surprising because the U.S. also ranks near the bottom in measures of social justice in the OECD. For African Americans, household wealth has virtually disappeared during the latest crisis. We should recognize that the grim legacy of slavery, which is one of the original sins of American society, along with the virtual elimination of the indigenous population, that legacy has never been overcome. There's some amelioration, but not much. Well, these things didn't just happen like a tornado. They are the results of quite deliberate policies over roughly the past generation, the period of the neoliberal so-called assault on the population, which has had similar effects elsewhere as well. And that's hardly surprising either. The fundamental doctrine of neoliberalism was well expressed by Adam Smith, what he called the vile maxim of the masters of mankind, all for ourselves and nothing for other people. And if the masters are given free rein, we should expect the kinds of social and economic disaster that we now see before our eyes. Well, there are alternatives, quoting Nobel laureate in economics Joseph Stiglitz points out there are alternatives, but we will not find them in the self-satisfied complacency of the elites whose incomes and stock portfolios are once again soaring. Only some people, it seems, must adjust to a permanently lower standard of living. Unfortunately, those people happen to be most people. In short, the vile maxim at work. These developments should not be confused with idealized workings of capitalism and free markets. On the other hand, on quite the contrary, policies are carefully designed to protect the masters from market discipline, that has always been true back to the 18th century, and to ensure that they can rely on the beneficence of the powerful nanny state that they carefully nurture for their benefit. Let's continue the exercise of this figuring out how to ruin an economy. I suppose we're intent on making the scandal even worse. Now, there are some good ways to proceed. So modern economies depend very heavily on R&D, research and development. Fundamental work comes primarily from the dynamic state sector, on which the advanced economy heavily relies. Almost most of the IT revolution, biology-based industries, and much else. Actually, that's a pattern that traces far back, but it's become much more critical since the Second World War, as the impact of science and technology on the society and the economy have greatly expanded. So a very good way to ruin the economy and the society would be to cut back on R&D, on federal R&D. And we can read about how that's done from the first issue of the AAAS Journal, American Association for Advancement of Science Journal, Science, the first issue in 2014. Here's what it says. The 2014 budget will continue what has been a decades-long slide in the ratio of federal R&D in the budget to the GDP. This ratio is often used as a measure of how much a nation values basic research. It's fallen 25% in the last decade alone, and that's continuing. In the meantime, elsewhere internationally, investment in science is rising as nations throughout the world connect investment in R&D to the development of their human capital and their future prosperity. For example, the European Union's flagship research program, Horizon 2020, is set to receive a nearly 30% boost in 2014. The Chinese government's investment in R&D has been increasing by percentages in the double digits for the last several years and is poised to become the world leader. You can draw the consequences without any comment. What's happening here is a very natural development of the imposition of the business model of seeking short-term profit, the future, the society, their someone else's business. Another way to undermine a healthy economy is to encourage the growth of financial institutions, giving them free rein by deregulation and using state power to underprice risk. These are actually crucial features of the neoliberal era. From the 1970s, accelerating since, there's been enormous expansion of the financial sector of the economy. By 2007, right before the latest crash, it had reached about 40% of corporate profits. Well, economic growth has continued during this period, though not at the earlier pace, but it's rather artificial. It's sustained by repeated bubbles. Each decade has had its bubble, the savings and loan bubble under Reagan, the tech bubble in the late Clinton years, and, of course, the housing bubble under Bush. When the last of these burst, it created a financial crisis that has had severe consequences for much of the global economy, and near-depression conditions persist for much of the domestic population. The costs of the latest of the housing bubble itself and loss of output are estimated by the Congressional Budget Office to be around $24 trillion. That's largely the fault of the Fed, which was mesmerized by quasi-religious doctrines about efficient markets and therefore could not comprehend what was very obviously happening right before their eyes as housing prices rose far beyond trend lines going back 100 years, and the bubble that could have been pricked wasn't. Well, the primary mechanism for rewarding the agents of the crises is the government insurance policy, known informally as too big to fail. And that guarantee goes far beyond the direct bailouts. It extends to cheap credit, to artificially high credit ratings, and many other devices. And the scale is huge. There's a recent IMF study which found that virtually the entire profit of the major banks traces to tacit government insurance. It reaches the level of $83 billion a year, according to analyses in the business press, it's Bloomberg News. The insurance policy, of course, leads to underpricing of risk, hence making the next crisis more likely. After the most recent crisis, several prominent economists, including Nobel laureates, raised the question of the general impact of financial institutions in the casino economy of the neoliberal period. And they also pointed out that that had not been much studied by economists. They suggested that inquiry would show that these institutions might be harmful to the economy. And there are some who go much farther. So perhaps the most respected financial correspondent in the English-speaking world is Martin Wolf of the London Financial Times. He concludes that, quote him, an out-of-control financial sector is eating out the modern market economy from inside, just as the larva of a spider wasp eats out the host in which it has been laid. Well, as in other developed societies, the economy, the U.S. economy, it's actually a state capitalist economy, but it's partially market-based. And markets have both positive and negative features. So that tells us another good way to ruin an economy and a society. Undermine the positive features and amplify the negative features. And in fact, huge resources are devoted to these tasks. The great benefit of markets is that they're supposed to provide consumer choice. It's only partially true, even in principle, but I'll put that aside. This beneficial consequence results from informed consumers making rational choices, as you learned in your economics courses. That's the core principle of markets. And as you all know, there's an enormous industry which is devoted to undermining this principle by creating uninformed consumers who will make irrational choices. It's known as the advertising industry. In a functioning market economy, ads would provide information to consumers about the products that are available. All you have to do is turn on a TV set to see that the goal is exactly the opposite. It's to undermine markets by delusion and manipulation, making sure that there are uninformed consumers who will make irrational choices. And in part, these efforts reflect another tendency that undermines markets. That's the rise of oligopolies, which has actually advanced considerably in recent years. Now, that offers opportunities to avoid price wars by tacit collusion. That shifts the goals of business to product differentiation, which is often quite meaningless, and it requires massive advertising to delude consumers. From an economic point of view, that's mostly waste, and it's enormous in scale. Well, these are among the ways to undermine the positive features of markets. There's a negative feature of markets intrinsic to them, called a market inefficiency, and that's ignoring externalities. So when a firm makes a risky transaction, if it's paying attention, it takes care to cover its own risk, but it does not consider systemic risk. That is the risk that the loss will affect others, maybe bring down the market, as say when AIG insurance collapsed, tanking the economy, or actually it would have tanked the economy, if the nanny state hadn't ridden to the rescue. Here, the government insurance policy plays a crucial role in amplifying a harmful feature of markets. Actually, there is a much more serious case of ignoring externalities, namely destruction of the commons. There's a standard notion, which you've heard, called the tragedy of the commons, which is supposed to mean that if the commons are held by the general public, they'll be destroyed, so therefore they have to be privatized. Actually, if you take a look at the facts, the opposite is usually true. It's privatizing that destroys the commons, and for good reasons. And we certainly should be aware of it today. The most significant case of destroying the commons is environmental catastrophe. Informed and rational people can hardly ignore the fact that the drive for short-term profits is leading directly to severe economic threats and imminent ones within the next generation or two. But that's another externality that's ignored. And in this case, there's no one around who can bail out the perpetrators. Can't run cap in hand to the nanny state and say, bail me out. Or the future generations whose chances of decent survival, they're placing at great risk. A future historian, and there may not be one, in fact, but if there is one, such a historian will look back on the current scene with some amazement. There are some who are trying to impede the threat of environmental catastrophe. There are others who are devoted to accelerating it. Who are they? Well, in the forefront of the struggle to overcome the threat are those who we call primitive, the First Nations in Canada, indigenous people in Latin America, Aboriginals in Australia, tribal communities in India, and their counterparts all over the world. And leading the race to disaster are the richest and most powerful countries in the world, the ones that have unique advantages, primarily the United States and Canada. Canada, in particular, has become the scourge of the world with its activities ranging from tar sands to mining activities that are destroying much of the world. These are countries with unique advantages, and they're in the lead to the race to destruction. The suicidal drive is conducted with considerable euphoria about what's called a century of energy independence, in which North America becomes the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century. The excitement is scarcely tainted by reflection on what the world will look like as fossil fuels are consumed with unrestrained exuberance. There's even gloating over the fact that Europe is reducing its efforts to move towards sustainable energy. Reason? It can't compete with U.S. production based on the cheaper energy that's destroying the world and society. The corporate sector has announced quite openly that it's carrying out major propaganda campaigns to convince the public that climate change, if it's happening at all, does not result from human activity. Now, these efforts are aimed at overcoming the excessive rationality of the public, which continues to be concerned about the threats that scientists overwhelmingly regard as near certain and quite ominous. All of that makes sense under prevailing ideology and prevailing institutional structure, which is directed towards pursuing the vile maxim of the masters of mankind. And in this case, it goes well beyond ruining an economy.
Professor Chomsky, in cases like in the southeast of Mexico, in Chiapas, we have several communities that have tried to fight the corrupt aspects of capitalism in their own way. How do we bring this aspect of attacks on capitalism to the urban environment and to cities, for example, like Detroit or Flint or Camden or Baltimore, that have seen the worst attacks of neoliberal policies?
Detroit is an interesting case. I mean, Detroit is overwhelmingly black, I can't find a document, but I'm convinced that that's the reason why it's being sent down the tube. If it was a white community, there'd be plenty of mechanisms available to bail it out, just as there are mechanisms available to bail out AIG and other criminals. And it's kind of interesting how it's done. So, for example, there's an attack on pensions. In violation of the state constitution, pensions are being cut back because of the crisis. This is not always done, so it takes AIG again. After their largely fraudulent, at least incompetent, probably criminal actions had practically destroyed the economy, and they were bailed out massively by the taxpayer, but the executives got huge bonuses. And there was some protest about that, but it was pointed out by eminent economists, Lawrence Summers for one, that we have to recognize sanctity of contract in that case, and not in the case of workers in Detroit who had already paid. Remember, pension means a cutback in wages. You're cutting back your wages, you'd already paid, you'd done the work, but in that case, sanctity of contract doesn't matter. Now, these are all parts of the neoliberal ideology, and it's had a very negative effect just about everywhere in the world. And the answer to your question is it's in the hands of people like you, just like trying to save the world from the environmental catastrophe that's coming is in your hands. Nobody else is going to do it.
A classic talk by Noam Chomsky. He spoke at Northeastern University in February 2014. The recording was produced and published by Leah Cohen. And I speak at the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding all that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.